My name is Kevin Zeese. I'm with Popular Resistance. Let me say how the day is going to go. We're going to have only one panel today. The idea for today is a group think, all of us working together, thinking through how we build a peace movement. And so the panel today is going to begin to kind of set the foundation for the day, frame the day for us. They'll each speak for 8 minutes. We may have a conversation among the panelists after that. If we have time, we'll go to the floor. But if not, going to the floor, then the rest of the day will be all from the floor. And we're going to start with going through some ongoing activities, ongoing campaigns. People can describe that so we know what's already going on, because at the end of the day, we want to figure out what our next steps are. So we want to know what's already happening. So we'll have people describe that. And then we are going to go through an exercise throughout the day, first examining the strengths and weaknesses of the peace movement, the challenges and opportunities that we face, and the goal then in the afternoon is to come up with short, medium, and long-term goals and our next steps. How do we continue to work together? And we are not creating a new organization here. We're not creating a new coalition here. We already have some excellent coalitions that are working on peace issues, and we want this to be a way to kind of bring all these groups together so we can plan next steps. We'll see if the Peace Congress continues to exist after today. This may just be a one-time event, or it may continue. We'll decide that as a group on what comes next. Let me say how this began. First off, let me just make this point. Today was supposed to be a glorious day for Donald Trump. He was supposed to have the military surrounding him, a massive military parade like Washington, D.C. has never seen before, closing with him surrounded by medals of honor and jets flying overhead. But instead of a military parade and glorification of militarism, we have a peace congress. And the reason we have a peace congress rather than a military parade today is because people organized to stop it. And what's really interesting about this organizing, it's unusual in that normally when you start to organize a campaign, you've got to convince the public that you're right. In this case, there was massive opposition to the military parade. People didn't want to see that kind of use of the military. Even veterans, active duty troops, no, people were saying no. Military families are saying no. Common citizens are saying no. Everyone was saying no. So we were on the side of the supermajority to begin with, which is amazing. And so we organized a coalition of 250 organizations in the at its peak, over 250. And we were putting out press releases, putting out statements. And in the end, the price tag for the military parade got leaked. Initially, it was a $12 million cost. The price tag grew to $92 million. And $13 million of that was to deal with us. the counter-protesters. They had budgeted $13 million more than the original price of the whole thing to deal with the counter-protests. And we had plans to have a large counter-protest. I think there was a lot of energy. We could have had a massive takeoff moment for the peace movement. But instead, we're here today to build the peace movement, and I think a slow and steady build, hopefully faster than slow, but a steady build is more powerful than one-time events. So hopefully you can turn that into something really strong. So we have to take credit for doing that. And I think we have to take credit for not stopping when we won that. We could have easily said, okay, we won, let's go home. Instead, the core organizer said, no, we're not going to let that dictate our terms. We want to help to build the peace movement. We got this energy. Let's build on it. And so we're going to have this assembly. We're calling a peace congress to work on how we can build the peace movement. So we have a handful of protesters today. Speakers. They would have been protesters. In fact, our first protester, speaker, Joe Lombardo from UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, has been a longtime social justice and anti-war activist. He's comments on a lot on independent media and on TV, and he was planning on bringing tens of thousands of people with him today to the protest. But instead, he'll be our lead-off speaker. And UNAC is a really important organization. There's a lot of great work. And so please welcome Joe to give us a kind of a sense of where the peace movement is.
So I've been around doing anti-war work for a long time. I started during the Vietnam War period when I was in college. And then I was a staff person for the National Peace Action Coalition, which was one of the two major coalitions that organized against the Vietnam War. And what I want to do in the 8 minutes that I have is try to talk a little bit about some of the differences between the Vietnam War period and the period that we're in now, and then just go over a few points that I think are essential given the period that we're in now for us to organize a movement that can be effective. Now, the Vietnam War was in the very beginning called one of the only consensus wars in U.S. history. In the very beginning of the Vietnam War, only 8% opposed it. And during the 9 years of that war, that 8% grew to about 88% of the population in the United States. And that mass sentiment was so large, it got down to every corner of the population. It was reflected in the culture, it was reflected in the mass demonstrations, it was reflected in the music, and it affected the soldiers, who were people like us, who many were drafted and so forth. And the soldiers became no longer a viable fighting force. If you see movies of that period, you'll see that there were peace signs on their helmets. The Black Liberation Movement was happening at the same time, the Women's Liberation Movement, the Gay Liberation Movement, and all these movements really had mass sentiment, and they were reflected within the military, and the military wouldn't obey their orders. They'd say, go take that hill, the officer would say, and they'd say, you go take that hill. And there were instances of fragging. In fact, there were over 300 instances of fragging that happened in the last year of the Vietnam War. The sentiment got so deep that when they finally lost the war, when the United States lost the war and brought people home, and you remember the scenes of people hanging onto helicopters and top of buildings and trying to get away, that they developed a phrase for what happened to the American population, and it was called the Vietnam Syndrome. They did not want to see another war like Vietnam again. They didn't understand why it happened anymore, that it was a mistake. They didn't want to see it anymore. And it really took a whole generation and 9/11 before they were able to do these wars again. And they went into Afghanistan after that and then went into Iraq. And you might remember right before they went into Iraq on February 15th, the largest demonstrations took place anywhere around the world. There were about 500,000 people in New York City. There were about 300,000 in San Francisco. There were 1 million in Rome. There were 1 million in London. There were 1 million in Tokyo. There were millions all over the world. In fact, it's the only internationally coordinated demonstrations that happened on every continent of the world simultaneously, even in Antarctica, where there were some research stations. The people came out from those research stations to oppose the war. And the New York Times said, now there are still two superpowers. Before there was the Soviet Union and the United States, now there was the United States and the people of the world. And we have to make that a reality, which we have not really done yet. Right after these demonstrations, Bush got on TV and they said, well, what do you think of all these demonstrations? Is it going to affect your policy? And he said, well, I think that was a good focus group that we saw out in the streets. But it made something clear to me that simple mass sentiment was not going to stop the war anymore. It had to be stronger. There had to be something else that was going to happen. And I think they were able to leave Vietnam, but were not able to leave Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or Yemen or any of these wars, because I think their system is in trouble. I think capitalism and imperialism is in trouble. And I don't have time in 8 minutes to go over all those things, but maybe in the discussion we can talk about why I say that. Because Trump obviously doesn't say that. He says, look, the economy's going better than ever before. That's bull. So they have a difficult time because so much of our economy is based upon the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, selling weapons overseas to all of these people, all of these countries. Imagine if they just demobilized the military and brought them home. Would there be jobs? Imagine if they just let the 2.2 million people who shouldn't be in jail out of jail. Would there be jobs? Our system could not support that kind of thing. And so war is an integral part today of everything we do in imperialism. And we have to learn how to fight against that. But more than that, every area of our society is under attack. The black community, immigrants, unions, workers. This is all part of what we call the war at home. And for many people, the particular attack they're under is the immediate threat. And war seems as a secondary threat. We have to learn to make that concrete for people, that all of their struggles have an international component, and all of the international struggles have a domestic component, and that's the war at home and war abroad that now the movement talks about in general ways. They learned things from Vietnam. They learned they didn't want to have a draft. They learned that the news media should not cover what happens. If you remember during Vietnam, they always had the number of people died, the heroes that was scrolling on the TV. That turned out to be a negative for them. People said, why are we getting all these people killed? 60,000 people died in Vietnam, Americans, and 4 million Vietnamese. We carpet bombed in North Vietnam. We destroyed the dikes and so forth. So I think there's a program that we need to look at in terms of building the movement today. First of all, we have to be very clear who is responsible. It's the United States of America. It's not Russia and China and the United States. It's the United States of America. We have troops in 172 countries. We have 20 times the number of military bases as all other countries in the world combined. Just the increase in our military budget is more than the military budget of all of Russia. We have to understand we have an international campaign, and we have a common cause with all the people who are being attacked by imperialism. If you could make it to Ireland next week, we're going to have a major conference on military bases. People from 35 countries and about 60 of us from the United States are going. Unity is extremely important in our movement. When we are small, we have to come together. We have to put together away some of the differences. That's why I organize in a coalition, UNAC, because I'm trying to bring these groups together. We have to be action and oriented. Everybody's upset about Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court, but you know, it was a Republican Supreme Court when Roe versus Wade was passed, but we were in the masses in the streets. And finally, we have to understand the wars at home and the wars abroad, and that racism has been part of every war to dehumanize people, whether they call them ragheads or gooks or whatever, and we have to fight against racism as an anti-war movement, and we have to fight together with all the people in struggle, and that's how we can build a strong movement.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you, Joe. So we're going to stay with that international issue right now, because imperialism is really the foundation of U.S. foreign policy and has been for a long time. Our next speaker, Bernard Ellerin, works on this issue from the perspective of the national spokesperson of the U.S. chapter of BAYAN, BAYAN USA. This is an alliance of 23 Filipino organizations across the United States: workers, immigrants, youth, students, women, culture workers, artists, and LGBTQ people. It's the main political center for anti-imperialist mass movement in the Philippines, BAYAN. It's the forefront of the struggle for national democracy with a socialist perspective. Ellerin's also a member of the International Coordinating Committee of the International League of People's Struggle, for a global anti-imperialist and democratic formation present in over 40 countries. It represents national and social liberation movements against imperialism and reaction. Please welcome
BAYAN Bernadette. Is an anti-imperialist alliance, Filipino anti-imperialist alliance, with a U.S. chapter. So in the Philippines, when we say anti-imperialism, what we really mean in our context is national liberation, because the Philippines was a direct colony and is now a neo-colony of the U.S. So we are trying to liberate ourselves from the clutches of U.S. imperialism that has seeped into every fabric of our society. So I'm going to talk a little bit about an incident that happened earlier this year in San Francisco. A comrade, a BAYAN comrade from Mindanao by the name of Jerome Aba, was traveling to the U.S. upon the invitation of churches here in D.C. who are convening for the Ecumenical Advocacy Days. You might be familiar because it takes place in D.C. every year. And they come together to talk about social issues, global issues, and then they advocate in Capitol Hill afterwards. So Jerome was a resource speaker on the Philippines. His port of entry was SFO, San Francisco International Airport, back in April. And on April 17, when he landed, we were waiting outside of the airport to receive him. He never left the airport. We found out through a glitch call of customs that he was being held up in the airport by customs. We immediately mobilized and organized a rally at the airport to demand his immediate release. We also went to the Philippine consulate to seek assistance from them. We rallied for over 24 hours, and then we were told that he was removed. He was forcibly removed and sent back to the Philippines. Jerome received a visa. He went through the whole process of going through what needed to be done to be able to come to the U.S. and speak upon the invitation of big churches here in the U.S. What he was supposed to talk about was the situation in Mindanao, in the southern Philippines, where there's a big U.S. military presence, and also the city of Marawi, which is a... Jerome is a Moro, meaning to say the Moro people are indigenous to Mindanao. They're also Muslim, so they're Islamicized indigenous. And for centuries, they have been waging anti-colonial armed struggle in Mindanao, the Moro people. That's Jerome's legacy. He comes from a legacy of Moro self-determination, which includes armed conflict, armed struggle in that part of the Philippines. So that's what he was supposed to talk about, how the city of Marawi was destroyed by U.S., supplied airstrikes by the Philippine military and, you know, this so-called threat of ISIS. But Jerome never made it outside because we found out when he testified back in Manila that for over 24 hours, he was tortured and detained within U.S. borders at the airport. And this happens here in the U.S. Rendition-style interrogations of visitors happen, take place here in the U.S. in our ports of entry. And Jerome was stripped naked, forced to field questions of whether or not he's with ISIS or a terrorist organization. He was denied food. Knowing that he was Muslim, they served him ham and pork. And he was also subjected to lack of sleep, subjected to psychological torture where after hours of being in isolation, they would place weapons in front of him, hoping that he would maybe take action, spontaneous action with a grenade or a gun in front of him. So we found out about this and we were really disheartened. And I think it really speaks to the U.S. not wanting Jerome to deliver his message of what the U.S. is doing in the Philippines. The Philippines is the largest recipient of U.S. aid in the Asia-Pacific region with over $150 million. And this aid is used to fund not only a Philippine military, but Philippine National Police, which are the main perpetrators of the drug war that we've heard about in the news, as well as the war against the opposition or those who in the Philippines who are critical of the government, like Bayan. So very recently, many of our leaders have been killed. A lawyer was killed just last week for defending the poor. The poor that he was defending were also subjected to a massacre. They were poor peasants who were part of a Bayan-affiliated union who were fighting for their land rights. So we're seeing not only an escalation of drug war, but also an escalation of politically motivated killings, especially of Bayan members. And all of these wars, the wars against the Moro, the drug war, the war against the opposition or human rights defenders, these are all U.S. proxy wars. They're all U.S. proxy wars because they are funded by U.S. aid. They are being waged to serve U.S. interests. They're not being waged really to help Filipinos. Or they're being done under the auspices of humanitarianism or counterterrorism, which is not true on the ground. So the U.S. is also conducting drone warfare in Mindanao. So we're talking about what does it take to build an effective and stronger peace movement here in the U.S. I think stories like Jerome needs to make it. You know, we need to know about these stories. But I think we should also have some sort of deeper understanding of what we mean by peace, because we're building a peace movement. You know, when we say peace in our struggle, we don't mean the peace of the graveyard. We don't mean the peace of nonviolence. We mean the peace of food on the table, the peace of freedom, the peace of sovereignty, the peace of justice, The peace of being able to benefit from our own natural resources, not being plundered by foreign national corporations. That's what we mean by peace. And if we have to fight for that, we will do it. So I think we have to level off and at least appreciate and deepen our understanding of what we mean by peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernadette. Next, we'll hear from Netfa Freeman, sitting on my left here. Netfa is an analyst and events coordinator at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an organizer of the Pan-African Community Action, also known as PACA. It's a D.C.-based grassroots group that works for community control of police. He's also on the coordinating committee of Black Alliance for Peace. Please welcome Netfa.
Thank you. I guess I want to start by saying a few things in terms of our analysis from Pan-African Community Action, which informs my remarks, is that African black people, you're going to hear me say African and black interchangeably because that's how I see it. We're African people. And in this country, we're colonized. We constitute a domestic colony. So that means that everything, every characteristic, every fundamental relationship that you can define between a colonizer and a colonized defines the relationship of African people in this country. And the three pillars of oppression are the things that we see are the dire circumstances that motivate war, imperialism and war. That's capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy. And the only way we can really understand this, and this is one of the urgent needs of our time, is for us to, and this is what we're working to do, is to kind of break what I refer to, this time I'm having to speak for myself and not PACA necessarily, I use the term Americanism. And so it's the notion that we share the same fundamental political, economic, cultural, what have you, interests of what has become known as the United States of America, and we don't. And if you look at our experience within this country, ever since African people were captive and brought here, enslaved and repressed, we can notice that there has been a war against us. If we fast forward and look at, and even some of the, I was listening to Joe Lombardi, which I really love that historical context that talks about the time, the era of the Vietnam War, in the 60s. And I would like to go back to that because at that same time, what Joe talked about is there was a revolutionary consciousness, or it's at least a consciousness of resistance, even among people who were enlisted and engaged in the war. To me, it seems like that has disappeared. And we have black people in this country, and this is what we have to attack, because a lot of it is an ideological war, too. We have to kind of attack the fundamental premises that we've been indoctrinated to. So now we can be enlisted in war in the U.S. military and then go and kill our sisters and brothers in Africa or someplace else. And I think Jama and I, well, he's going to talk a little bit more about AFRICOM and whatnot, but I want to talk about how AFRICOM is a counterpart to what is known as the 1033 program. People who may not understand this, this is the act, legislation that helps the transfer of equipment, military-grade equipment from the Department of Defense into local law enforcement. And so this is the militarization of police forces that are primarily used in black and brown communities around this country to keep us in line. Now, this is not the beginning of the militarization of the police. The beginning of it, we can go back as far as what Joe was talking about, that era, and we know them as SWAT. They make all kind of television programs. They still make television programs around SWAT. And that was the beginning of it. And if we have to understand that the first operations of SWAT, just like on the African continent, were to take down the liberation movements. In 1969, I believe, the first operation of SWAT was a standoff, a four-hour standoff between the Black Panther Party and SWAT. And this is what they're, you know, this is why they came about, not because of anything else. You can imagine what other purpose would a militarized police force need. And they formalized it in the 1033 program, which was in 1990, and actually not just formalized it, increased it, made it more sophisticated, solidified the cooperation between the Department of Defense and the police forces in 1997, I believe. It was the Clinton administration. So now we're looking at that. The same, most people probably know about the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI that was used to undermine social justice movements, notably the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement. Well, the same thing was happening on the African continent with the CIA, overthrowing governments, all this kind of stuff. There's been a war against African people. Now we're taught through school that, quote unquote, we share the same interests of America, that we're, quote unquote, American. You use the term African-American. I myself think that it's pretty much an oxymoron. The policies that really look at our people in the country domestically and foreign policy means that what Americanism means is diametrically opposed to our interests. And we're taught things in history and everything that we share the same interests as what is Americanism. And I'm not trying to disparage anybody, but we have to really think about the underpinnings and presumptions that we're indoctrinated into. So we fast forward, now we have AFRICOM, we have the 1033 program, we have people who are thinking, who are like indoctrinated so much that they'll join the military and think nothing of being deployed to Africa. You know, we heard not too long ago about the young man, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, who was killed in Niger. And people didn't even know that the U.S. had troops in Africa until that time. And this is an African person, African descent, going and, you know, doing something that's diametrically opposed to his interests. Now, this is also a class war, because it's only the working class people who are having to be in a position, whether you're employed or not, to sell our labor for wages to capitalists. So that's the working class. It doesn't matter whether you have a job or not. That's how I define it, right? And so we have to begin, and just to get to the exigencies, that part of our movement is a consciousness-raising thing, and we hope we can take advantage of the consciousness that emerged and the resistance around the movement for Black Lives, which is looking at the police assault on us, and that's kind of diminishing, but we want to revitalize that. And then we want to make it more sophisticated so that we're connecting the militarization of police and militarizations in our communities with what's happening on the continent of Africa. And then connecting that with the total pro-peace, anti-war, anti-imperialism. And we also need to connect imperialism and anti-imperialism and war. You know, they're inextricably, there's wars because there's imperialism. And people think of that as a very, you know, it's a rhetorical catchword, but we have to study what imperialism means, is the globalizing of international finance, capital, and whatnot. So we have to wage this ideological battle as well, and raising the consciousness of our people so that our movements are not just, when we're mobilizing on the street, not just moving against what the police are doing to us locally, but linking that and making that inseparable from the movements to demilitarize the world. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Netva. Next is Angela Bibbins Henry. She's a Santee Dakota descendant, former ground coordinator and founding member of the Water Protector Legal Collective, where she spent 6 months providing legal support services for the defense of water protectors in North Dakota. Angela is also the founder of Red Owl Law, an indigenous-focused law firm in Aurora, Colorado. She's a 2006 graduate of the University of Denver Sturm College of Law, and admitted to practice in Colorado state courts, federal courts in Colorado and North Dakota. Angela has experience in environmental and criminal defense law, movement support, expertise in the Indian child welfare and juvenile law as well. Please welcome Angela Bibbins Henry.
Angela Bibbins Washichu Imachiape Heshka Adwati Damakota Iaska. My relatives, I greet you with a warm heart and a happy handshake. I said in my language in Dakota that I am Angela Bibbins Henry, and I am Dakota, and I am mixed blood. I am Yeska, that's our word. It means translator as well. And so it is literally the position that I occupy in my culture and in this society, of being at the intersection of race, culture, sovereignty, socioeconomic background. And I'll trace a little bit about my own personal family history, because it is important, because it's a history that has been suppressed in this country. I wear the face of the colonizer, and that is by design of federal policy. And I just want to let that sit with everybody for a moment, because I am a descendant of the 38 Dakotas who were hung at Mankato, Minnesota in 1862 by the decree of President Abraham Lincoln, the great quote-unquote emancipator. And so I want to just trace that back for a few minutes, because that is how we got to Standing Rock. My tribe was not a signatory to the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty. The treaty had first been attempted in 1851. My original homelands are in Minnesota, and I joke, you know, with a little bit of levity, that if I were to be granted my homelands again, it would be the Mall of America. But in all seriousness, we are people who are connected to the land. This land is where we find our medicine. This land is where we find our sustenance, our food, our shelter, our clothing, all of our ceremonies. We are star people. This was a gift from my dad. This is who we are, where we come from, and where we return when we make our journey on the star road to the star camp when we are done with this material world. And so I just want to relay to you what it is that we were doing in our fight to protect our land at Standing Rock, the sacred sites. We are people who look at the stars and we put those effigies out on the land to reflect what we see in the sky. And that is what was destroyed on the first day. And I think that there are people here who were there and stood with us in solidarity. And I want to thank you for that. The day that the sacred sites were destroyed on September 3rd, when the dog bite attacks occurred. And what had happened before that, my uncle, Dekshi Tim Mentz, who was the previous tribal historic preservation officer for Standing Rock, had mapped out those sacred sites. That's his life's work, is to protect and preserve our sacred sites throughout the Northern Plains. And he had given that map to Earth Justice attorneys. They had filed it with the court in here in D.C. to be able to demonstrate the harm that could be done. Well, the corporation, Dakota Access Pipeline, took that map, and they, on a holiday weekend, diverted all of their resources from where they had been building the pipeline further north to closer to camp, exactly where those sites were, so that they could run bulldozers through our ancestors' graves and destroy those effigies of the star constellations on the ground. It was a spiritual war on us that continues to this day. My grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, Patrick Henry, was one of 100 men who made the long journey from Mankato, Minnesota, Fort Snelling, prisoner of war. They marched them. This is our Trail of Tears. You don't know about Asante people's Trail of Tears, right? Because there were so few of us. Only 400 adults made it over a course of 3 years from one camp to another camp, finally across the Missouri River to Nebraska, northeast Nebraska, in Ponca territory, where my reservation has been for over the last 100 years. When I went to my reservation last month for one of the first times in over a decade, because I was not raised with my culture, my white mother left my father when I was 9 months old. I have spent the last 15 years trying to discover my truth as my consciousness keeps evolving into my identity. This is the intentional erasure of us. This is the genocide that is perpetrated against tribal people on this continent, in our own country, that we will be erased. I was the perfect result of these policies of boarding school, of war, of adoption out of our children to white families, being raised by white parents, intermarriage. the removal of us from our homelands to urban centers. This is all part of acts of genocide to exterminate us. I did not agree. And so I have asserted my heritage. I have asserted my identity. I went to Standing Rock to defend my people and defend my homelands against the invasion of a corporation which was defended by the U.S. militarization of the police. We had dark sites. We had people who were missing for more than 24 hours, who were injured at the front lines, who were chained to hospital beds. There was definitely COINTELPRO activities going on. They put an informant in with my sister Red Fawn to convert her, planted a gun on her, and now she is serving 5 years in a federal prison. This is an ongoing war, and we do need help with this struggle. We cannot do this alone. Intersectionality is the only way that we are going to prevail in any kind of peace in our homes. That's why I'm here today, to make my plea for my people that we continue as allies to continue educating yourself about the history of your own government here at home so that we can fight these wars, so that my relatives don't have to go off to foreign wars because of poverty, because we are working class, because that's the only option that we have other than what is going on with the epidemic of meth on our reservations, the epidemic of poverty, the epidemic of lack of access, and what is going on in this administration right now is an ongoing genocide in trying to remove those entitlements, not a benefit, entitlement given in exchange, health and education in exchange for land and resources. So with that, I want to thank you. Wapira Tonka.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Our next speaker, Sherry Honkala, drove down from Philadelphia this morning with her crew. She's a longtime anti-poverty advocate, co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, and co-founder of the National Coordinator of the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign. She ran for vice president in 2012 with Jill Stein and has run for other offices as a Green Party candidate. She's organized numerous protests, marches, demonstrations, sit-ins. She set up tent cities, and she's taken over abandoned buildings. She fights against poverty, foreclosures, evictions, and homelessness. In the course of all these activities, Sherry has been arrested for civil disobedience more than 200 times. Please welcome Sherry Honkala.
Okay, another woman from Minnesota. If you want to pass out the graphics to each side of the room while I've got my 8 minutes. Because I think that when you talk about the war at home, it's really important to visualize. Although we have photographs of Brazil, Africa, other parts of the world, this is North Philly, where we currently do a bulk of our work. And what they are is they're homeless encampments and stuff where people are living outside. So I just want to say a couple things about why I'm so dysfunctional and why I have the attitude problem that I have. Is one, I'm from Minnesota. And when I was 19 years old, my indigenous brother jumped off the Blaisdell Bridge. And most of you don't, maybe you don't know the secret about me, but when I was a little girl, I was taken from my mother and raised in 9 different institutions before I was 16. So I've always been a big one about, like, nothing about us without us. Because you can probably mention any kind of major tragedy. And I'm not proud to say. I'm proud to say that I'm still standing here. But most of the time I'll say, been there. And I will say one of the most tragic things that's happening right now in this country is watching the taking of children, but just a reminder that's gone on since the beginning of time. And I just want to say that as members of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, I think because we're constantly up against the state, there's real no illusion of security. We know about militarism from the time that our kids are walking outside the door We better school them if they want to come back home alive. I live on 7th in Indiana and Philadelphia. Two people have died this year on my block, one in front of my house. And when we talk about the draft, and there's not a draft, there's really an economic draft. Even some of our young people that we raised in this movement, we said, don't go to war, blah, blah, blah. They're like, I need to eat. I need health care. I need housing. And all those military recruiters are in our schools without any challenges. So what do we do? Right now, we call this thing no different than war. That's why we like to travel with our veterans. Secrets here that most of the people that I travel with and that are in leadership are also, no mistake, vets. You know, both Galen, Pastor Keith, these are veterans. And so studying things like strategy and how we're going to develop our own poor people's army to combat the things that we're dealing with, we're not talking abstractly or maybe kind of sort of. It's very real. It's very concrete. We know that the U.S. lawless exceptionalism has killed upwards of 15 million people around the world, around the globe. But we also know in one of the epic centers in the country, in the neighborhood I live in, more people have died from the opiate crisis than the Vietnam War. And there is no massive march. There is no massive human rights monitors. There is nobody to help bury these people. I got a call from my son's father, who's dying of AIDS, last week. He was at Jefferson Hospital, still living underneath one of those bridges. Most people fight to try and get into recovery because they can't get into recovery. They said they have to amputate both of his legs. He said that he needed some methadone. And he didn't want to leave out of the hospital because he knew that they have to seriously deal with his legs. He took off the IVs in his arm, left the hospital because the hospital wouldn't give him the methadone. These are the kinds of things our children have to deal with on a weekly basis. My 17-year-old kid has had to participate in most funerals. I mean, it's just a regular thing. If you're in Kensington, you hear ambulance all the time. And it's like a regular thing now. Make sure you carry some Narcanon in your glove compartment so you can potentially bring somebody back to life. One of Galen's best friends OD'd last week, and he attended the funeral. So these are the kinds of things that we're having to deal with on a regular basis. We don't talk about them as an integral part of the peace movement. They need to become an integral part of the peace movement. And then we can change the color of the room. Resistance. We have to stop being afraid to speak truth in the room. Even if you're seen as an agitator, Sherry Honkla with an attitude problem, you're not a team player. But you need to call out this phony resistance. Amen. This idea that we can just continue to close our eyes and blindly follow the Democratic Party when they're responsible for the killing of people at home and abroad cannot be done anymore. So we need to dare to be brave. And not say the popular things and be a part of the popular, I don't know, blue ripple. Because it sure the hell wasn't a blue wave when only 13% of our youth were registered with all the damn money that made it around this country to make sure that they did get registered. Progressives have also aligned themselves with the Democratic Party that create all these front fake organizations around every identity issue, around every horrible thing that's happening in this world. And we need to be able to say no more. We need to begin to say, hi, how are you? What organization are you from? And where do you get your money? So I'll end this with saying that a lot of who we are and what we're trying to do, we're literally forming the Poor People's Army. You'll see, next time you'll see us, you're going to see the pastors in black vests. We're going to be passing out the stripes and the stars and the badges for humanity in our Poor People's Army. And our goal is to defend our families. Our ability to live and survive is not up for negotiations. We're not waiting. So whether it means reclaiming housing, land, you name it, we are going to live and we're going to survive this thing. April 4th, you know, one of the consequences of always, you know, going to jail is sometimes you come up against some really dangerous stuff. April 4th, I begin a week-long trial here in Washington, D.C., because we had a Poor People's March. We went to Washington, D.C., and we took over Housing and Urban Development. They're refusing to drop the charges. We have a full jury trial the week of April 4th. Our main issue was calling attention to the devastation of the thousands of people that lost their lives in Puerto Rico and are still needing housing. That's it.
We're going to end this panel with Ajamu Baraka. He's a veteran of the U.S. Black Liberation Movement, internationally recognized as a human rights activist, organizer, and geopolitical analyst. 4 decades of domestic and international involvement in political issues. Baraka was the vice presidential candidate for the Green Party in 2016. He's an editor and contributing columnist for Black Agenda Report, and contributes a number of other independent media outlets and publications. He's currently the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace and a member of the UNAC Administrative Committee, as well as the Executive Committee of the Coalition to Close U.S. Foreign Bases, which is planning the global conference to close U.S. and NATO bases scheduled for Ireland next week. Please welcome Ajamu Baraka.
Thank you, Kevin, and thank all of you for joining us this morning for this very important conversation. So I greet you by saying, all power to the people. All power to the people. Our responsibility here this morning, our responsibility is to, in fact, build a movement to shift power from the oppressors to the people. That is the purpose of this gathering. That is the objective of the movement that we have to strengthen and expand. This gathering today is part of that process, and I'm so honored to be a part of that. We are pretty much on the same page in terms of having a sense of what we are up against. So I'm not going to engage in a lot of conversation around the analysis, but I do want to talk about where we need to go. By first going back and looking at the context that Joe and NETFA and others have talked about, looking at the comparison between the last time we had a very vigorous anti-war, anti-imperialist movement here in this country in the 1960s and early 70s, and today. Now, that's important to make the comparison because one of the reasons how we can explain the relative support that we saw from most of the people in this country in the initial stages of the Vietnam conflict in the 1960s is very similar to why we see the relative silence among the majority of the people today in face of a very aggressive and clear imperialist agenda by both parties. And I would say that the way one explains that is this. In the post-war period, that is right after the Second Imperialist War that we refer to as the Second World War, the first major adventure, military adventure, was in what nation?
Korea.
And who was the president? Truman. And what party was he from? A Democrat. 1960s, the expansion or the taking over of the defeat that the French suffered in Vietnam. Who was in power as the U.S. military began to expand its presence in Vietnam? John F. Kennedy. What party? The Democrats. What we have seen, my friends, is that one of the consequences of the imperialist project in this country has been that the people have supported U.S. aggression, and they have often supported U.S. aggression and U.S. imperialism because we've had this political cover provided by the Democrats. It is such a strange phenomenon, though, that when you talk to people and you talk about what party is more aggressive, what party is the party of war, and 8 times out of 10, people will identify the Republicans. But we know it's been basically the Democrats as also the party of war. So what that means is that we have to penetrate this distortion. As Sherry was saying, we have to be the ones to consistently speak truth to power, to be the ones that will be unpopular in those rooms with our friends who are Democrat Party supporters, who are confused about the role of the state and the role of the Democrat Party. We have to be the ones to remind people of the reality of the bipartisan commitment to the agenda of permanent war. We have to be the ones to do that. We have to be the ones to remind people that what we are looking at when we look at this issue of permanent war, the war is in fact a class issue. That basically the people who are being called on to go off and to fight and to die are from the working class and the poor in this country. And who are they fighting against? The working class, the oppressed, the poor of other nations. That's why in the Black Alliance for Peace, we are absolutely clear. We say not one drop of blood from the working class or poor people in defense of the capitalist oligarchy. We're clear about that. We have to be the ones to speak truth to power. We have to be the ones to make that connection between our opposition to war and aggression and imperialism globally and the war being waged in this country. A war that has both a military and a structural character. A military in the sense that we don't have time to get into it, but we know that those of us who are part of the Black Liberation Movement, that we suffered a military assault against our movement as part of the counterinsurgency process. We know that today, as Brother Netfa talked about, that we're up against a militarized domestic army that we call the police forces. A domestic army that's been equipped to the teeth with the latest and most advanced weaponry. That is the consequence of this Department of Defense 1033 program. $4 billion worth of military-grade equipment has been transferred from the federal government to police forces across this country. And we know that the primary communities that they're concerned about control and containment are who? The Black and brown communities here in this country. You connect that with mass incarceration. You connect that with the structural reality of grinding poverty. And that translates, my friends, into a systematic war being waged against people in this country. That war being waged, that structural war, that war that is a fundamental component of capitalism, is also how we explain the globalized imperialist project. We understand and we say peace is something we want. All rational human beings want to live in a society where you have peace. But we understand that without justice, there could be no peace. And the only way you can arrive at peace, you got to do what? You got to fight for it. So this structural violence that we see in this country is the flip side of the structural globalized capitalist violence we see around the world. So for us, the only way we have peace, the only way we have justice, is when we recognize and we name the enemy and we're prepared to struggle against that enemy. So my friends, today is an important day. It's a day that we're going to claim victory, not only because we stopped that military parade, but because we are building a new movement. And we know that we are on the right side of history. So thank you for coming out. Keep on organizing. Keep on building.
Let me first ask the panel the question of the day. What are the weaknesses of the peace movement today, and what are our strengths? What are our opportunities, and what are our challenges? And you have 30 seconds. No, just kidding.
There are many weaknesses, and there are real strengths. The real strength is, I agree with what a panelist said about the Democrats and Republicans, bipartisan war. The Democrats today are to the right of the Republicans on the question of war. They don't want to talk to North Korea. They don't want to talk to Russia. And the attacks they do on these countries are building a case for war. And we're talking about the possibility of nuclear war. So that is a very big problem. But what they do and their policies are against the interest of the vast majority of people in this country, which means we as a movement have the potential to mobilize that vast majority. And if we do mobilize that vast majority, no amount of money or weapons or control of the media or anything could stand in our way. Because if we were really organized together, all we would have to do is stand there and put our hands in our pockets and refuse to cooperate, and their whole system would come tumbling down. So that is our strength. Our strength is in our numbers. Our strength is in the fact that their policies are against their interests, and everything we say, even though we don't have much control of the media, everything we say busts that bubble a little bit, continues to bust that bubble. So we must get out there. There's obvious weaknesses. One of them is to look around the room and see what the obvious weaknesses are. I don't have to explain it because you've heard that many times before. Part of it is demographics. Part of it is age. There was a break, as I said, between the anti-war movement, which was very youthful during the Vietnam War, and our next piece of the anti-war movement. That was also a generational break. And we live in a country where older people, because of experience and because of what they gain in terms of wisdom and so forth, is not cared about because we live in a capitalist country. You're no longer useful when you're no longer producing wealth for the capitalists. So they throw us aside. In almost every other culture, older people are revered for what they know and so forth. So that becomes a weakness, too, that we have to bridge that gap as we talk about bridging the gaps between the wars at home and abroad and getting all this together. So there are some weaknesses that we have. Unity is another one. We are so divided in this capitalist culture, ego, and you could make it on your own. They never talk about that we have a country, the richest country in the world, that can provide for everybody. They say we can provide opportunity for everybody. And so that you can make it divides us and it keeps ego and so forth. So unity is a very big weakness that we have to overcome, and this meeting is helping to do that.
I just wanted to address one of the obvious things to me as a mother who brought my son, Ben, stand up and say hi. he's the youngest youth in the room, as I can account. And so that's the obvious. That's, to me, one of the things that happened at Standing Rock that was so amazing is that it was an intergenerational response. We had old Amesters, American Indian Movement, and new youth that came. And the average age of an arrestee at Standing Rock was somewhere between 18 and 25. We had the cream of the crop in Indian country, folks that had never had police contact before in their life. I counseled those folks. I did those bail advisements by the hundreds. And I learned a lot from our youth in that movement. I learned a lot about technology and social media, because I am squarely in Generation X, and who raised ourselves, by the way, and because you guys were all out in the streets protesting. well, somebody had to do all the work at home. But I just want to encourage you, there are so many youthful movements in this country that are vibrant and thriving right now, and we do need our elders. I need my elders, too. I confer with them. I consult with them. I respect them. I regard them for the work that I do. We have a lot of protocol in my culture, and to speak in front of my elders sometimes is even to break protocol. So I just want to encourage the folks in this room to think about who's not in the room and to think about coalition building.
I wouldn't call it a strength, but I think what's working to our, in our, what we have in our favor is the crisis of imperialism itself is so bad that it creates the best conditions for us to unite against the common enemy and to also raise our level of work, movement, and resistance. All over the world, there are people who are resisting 24/7, especially in the poor countries. But the level of poverty in the poor countries, especially in the Philippines, in Latin America, and Africa, used to be much lower than the level of poverty here in the U.S. But because of the crisis, that is evening out. So you have levels of poverty here in the U.S. that are very akin to the levels of poverty in the global south. So there's a lot of favorable condition for unity and understanding in internationalism. And those of us who are bearing the brunt of this crisis, the debt crisis, the food crisis, the hunger crisis, the jobs crisis, our youth are part of the workforce who are suffering the brunt of this crisis. And I think it's a matter of linking and raising the lessons of the past with the realities of now, and really being able to connect our issues and not seeing our issues as separate and disparate, because they're really not. So I think that's the challenge of building unity. It's a lot of work that we have to put time and energy in, and we just have to do it. We just have to do it. And, you know, the youth will respond when you talk about not having a job, being in student loan debt. They'll respond to that if we can meet them where they're at and really link and raise their bread and butter issues to global issues, because the youth of the world are suffering from the same crisis.
One of the things I think is one of the, I don't know if you call it a weakness, but a challenge, it is a weakness. And I think it's an elephant in the room, at least in progressive circles, the nonprofit industrial complex. And I think it is really, you know, and we touched on it. It's also, there's opportunity. It's a lot to do with the political education. How do we frame, how do we understand issues? And the nonprofit industrial complex is huge in terms of the facade of where progressivism is and what progressivism is and all that kind of stuff. It's you know, controlled by those who invariably have funding, who are probably more too conservative to really address the what we're trying to deal with. The other thing is the media has become more sophisticated. So this is a double-edged one. And this is, you know, the fact that media has become more sophisticated and pervasive, but it also has become, there's social media and other ways. We're even able to stream this live right now and be able to get people. So there's a double-edged sword to that. But when we deal with an ideological framework or some fundamental principles, values, or something, we got to kind of recapture that from a system that's much more sophisticated and propagating its own things. And I think Bernadette touched on the youth. And that last thing is the opportunity is that now we have a movement, young people, who are talking about intersectionality. And that's even trying to be co-opted by the nonprofit industrial complex. But what we have to do now, and it makes it easier for us to do, is to make sure that it's really understood what it means and also inject class into that. I think they try to sterilize it from the class aspect.
I think there's a whole misappropriation of funds from the nonprofit industrial complex. And I think that all those resources are consciously by our enemy funneled in that direction to other front organizations. And I think that if we really care about these issues, we're going to figure out how to finance them. You know, and I'm talking from somebody that knows how to, you know, make a miracle out of a loaf of bread, and I'm not Jesus. But anyway, and we have to consciously begin to call it out. We build in this army. Who the hell really is our friends? Where are our troops? Who's really on our side? And we need to have that conversation because we need a new political alignment. And we don't have time for guilt. This is a numbers game. We need everybody in. And as my sister said here, there's so much wisdom in this room. We have so much to learn from our elders. You see, I didn't call myself an elder. I'm still a part of the youth. And we really got to tackle this social media thing. Because where I live, you don't really have access to the internet unless you can get outside of McDonald's. And there's better internet connections in Chiapas than there is in the South and in some very impoverished urban areas in this country. And we have to tackle that one. And how do we consciously lift up our CNNs, you know, Popular Resistance and the Black Agenda Project? That has to be a conscious effort. We're talking about creating massive political education. There's got to be a conscious effort to do things like that as well.
Very briefly, the weaknesses we have to address. We have to address the disunity in the movement. We have to address the fact that the movement is still primarily controlled by class elements that may not be as understanding of the need to diversify the movement and to really ground it in a class analysis. We've got to diversify in terms of the demographics, young people, and we've got to understand that there's going to be a diversification of this movement, but it won't be as a consequence of necessarily the folks in this room doing that, but as a consequence of people organizing themselves, engaged in self-organization, and then being a part of this community. And that's, in fact, what we're trying to do with the Black Alliance for Peace, that we're not interested in individuals attempting to enter these spaces as individuals. We are organizing our community into a self-conscious, self-determinant, organized block. And then we are participating in these communities from that standpoint. And I think that's a good thing because we understand and we recognize that progressive politics in this country only move forward when you have an organized base of Black radicals who are at the center of that process. That's not being chauvinistic or anything like that. It's just an objective fact. So we are organizing to try to strengthen that component of our movement. Our strengths, we're on the right side of history. We understand that the state has to and will become even more aggressive because of its legitimation crisis, and that provides us more opportunities to organize ourselves and to begin to expand and deepen.
So we have a few minutes. What I want to do is take a few comments from the audience. Then I'll let them respond to those comments. Then we'll go into the next section, which is going to be talking about current ongoing campaigns.
Quick comment. I just came from the Parliament of the World's Religions and learned a new term about colonization in Africa by religious and the elite. They're banding together to take over the mind and the hearts there. Also from Unrig the System Summit, we also have a political industrial complex. So we have the religious industrial complex and the political industrial complex that needs to be added to your nonprofit complex.
I'd just like to throw this out, hopefully that people will address it maybe a little later point. The Democratic Party has ceded the class struggle to the Republicans. It's Trump who's seen as the champion of coal miners, of workers in the Rust Belt, of people who have been neglected by Wall Street, people who have been insulted by what they see as a political elite. When Trump gives a tax cut and the average family hopes to get $1,000. And the Democratic Party says, see, that's nothing. And the average working person says, if you think $1,000 is nothing, you don't know anything about my life. In Eastern Europe, right-wing governments have come to power in Poland, Hungary, Austria, Italy, Ukraine. And they've done it by building a nationalist populist movement that makes an overture to the working class while building up hatred of immigrants. That's their formula. And it's emerging in England and in France and in Germany as well. Trump represents that tendency in this country. What we need is a left-wing populism that appeals to all workers on a class basis, but also puts at the center of its program anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobic, and respect for the right of oppressed peoples to self-determination. If we don't do that, we will not reach out to the working class. They won't respond. And a left-wing populism to counter the right-wing nationalist populism that unites the struggle against wars abroad with the struggles here at home, I think is the formula that can carry us forward.
One more comment.
I'm going to say a word, climate change. It wasn't mentioned. It was touched on a little. Standing Rock was a struggle for climate and energy justice. And I think this is a huge weakness and opportunity to build a movement, a global movement, because if the biggest threats to humanity are catastrophic climate change with horrors much worse than we see now. Nuclear war is a continuing possibility, but it's not inevitable. But I would submit that the military-industrial, fossil-fuel, nuclear, state terror and surveillance complex is the biggest obstacle standing in our way to an eco-socialist future, which I think is the imperative by demilitarizing and, as Netfer pointed out. So that's my comment.
And I'm going to let the panelists... I want to make one comment you can also consider responding to. We haven't talked about either, the end of U.S. empire. There's lots of evidence that U.S. empire is fading. We are way overburdened financially on that front. We are losing respect around the world. We are not winning wars. We're creating chaos. And lots of people are saying empire is on its decline. In fact, the Pentagon's even saying it. A year and a half ago, the Pentagon issued a report that talked about the end of unitary power. They see it coming. That's a challenge and an opportunity for the peace movement. How do we deal with these next 10 years? People saying by 2030 it's finished. Maybe sooner. How do we deal with that challenge and opportunity?
Quickly, in replying to what Phil brought up about fascism, I think we, as an anti-war movement, we should also deal with rising militarism and rising fascism around the world by U.S. imperialism and other global monopoly powers. It's a trend all over the world, and it is really symptomatic of the fact that imperialism is in crisis. The ruling financial elite everywhere around the world need to devise a scheme to divide the working class and divert their attention from what they're actually committing, the crimes that they're committing, that they're actually the ones responsible for growing economic hardship. They're the ones responsible for impoverishment of countries. They're the ones responsible for the debt crisis. But in order to do that, they have to create enemies or so-called boogeymen from amongst the working class, and therefore they have to sow division. They have to show anti-immigrant sentiment. They have to sow up xenophobia. They have to drum up racism amongst the working class to divide the working class, to make the working class believe that it's not the ruling class that's taking away their jobs, it's the immigrants taking away their jobs. And it's also very much aligned with the ruling class's intention to drum up the war economy, to militarize the borders, to fund proxy wars overseas. You know, the U.S. funds both sides, not just U.S. armies, but also proxy armies and also counter-revolutionary armies around the world that they say are U.S. enemies. So U.S. needs to drum up its military-industrial complex. It's also its prison-industrial complex. It creates the enemies amongst the people in order to incarcerate, criminalize, and maintain the economy this way. It's true, the Democrats are also a war party, but they're also a ruling class party. If we're really going to talk about sharpening the class struggle, the Democrats are not just a war party. They are a section of the financial oligarchy, and we have to remember that. I mean, both parties, they're all ruling class parties. I have yet to see a genuine working class party, not of that class, not of the financial oligarchy.
You know, there's also this thing, and I'm just going to pass it down, that these people that are so-called socialists think they're going to bring socialism by joining by candidates running on the Democratic Party, which is kind of ridiculous. Obviously, you can't run that. So we need to do that. But I think, I'll just add, it seems to me that the party alternative, the electoral process, has to be fortified by something being done in the interim. People's needs have to be being met. Other things have to be challenged by whatever it is going to run in the election. So people can tie that to not just see it when the elections come, see this alternative, but see this alternative throughout in the interim so they can begin to get some faith behind it and support.
I would just say that the climate crisis, we all know, is a systems crisis. And I think I did allude to it when I talked about Puerto Rico. You know, and several of our efforts to, like, get arrested, bring attention to what's happened there, to go to the Organization of American States to file paperwork. I think that the climate crisis is also this larger health crisis as well. Everybody that I know in the community, somebody has hepatitis A, there's a huge AIDS epidemic, not to mention all of our children, you know, as soon as they're born, they go to the asthma room. So I want to flag that as well, because it might not be seen in some of the traditional ways that the climate crisis is talked about in this country, but very much is a central issue because we're generally the ones that are living on top of the refineries, the Superfund sites, all of those kinds of things, and are the ones that cannot figure out how to survive afterwards. But we also are the people that are holding the marches, marching for green jobs, and talking about some of the changes that need to happen. And I just also want to say, in terms of the empire, yes, the empire is very much dying. That's very exciting. And I think it's really important that we also learn from our international relationships and to strengthen those relationships around the world, because massive groups of people that have nothing have been doing some pretty amazing organizing work in all over the world and don't have some of the hang-ups in terms of organizational structures and stuff that we have to deal with here in the belly of the beast.
I wanted to say a few things also along the lines of imperialism and climate, massive climate disruption that we are in the middle of. It has not just begun. We are in it. And the rise of fascism. We just had an election in South America in which a grandson of a Nazi was elected president of one of the biggest countries in South America. And that country, Brazil, holds the lungs of this planet, and it is in danger. And indigenous people, we are the keepers. We're like less than 5% of the population of the world in our original homelands, and we are trying to do our best to protect 80% of what keeps this planet in balance. And when we have imperialism, when we have fascism, and we have the displacement of indigenous people, we are severely out of balance. What is going on with our Condor relatives who are making their way to the border right now is the result of imperialism, is a result of U.S. imperialism. And I just want to bring that point to light, because those asylum seekers, we have traditional migration routes up and down this hemisphere. They are our birthrights. Moving across these so-called borders doesn't register in our consciousness in the same way as it does in the consciousness of the colonizer.
Mm-hmm. Very briefly, to Phil's very important question, we have to deal with this issue of the subjective factor, this issue of how do we explain the fact that not only in this country, but in Western Europe, we find that the left, the European left, will find itself on the same side with imperialism. And the only way that's explained is that there seems to be some kind of cultural and psychological identification with their national bourgeoisie. So how do we explain that? Well, you can't explain that without looking at very seriously this issue of race and understanding its complexities and understanding white supremacist ideology. It is that factor that is undermining our ability to build authentic working class unity. In other words, it is the prevalence of identity politics, of course, but white identity politics. That basically this notion of some type of fundamental connection between white people and the idea that Europeans are part of some kind of superior civilization serves as a basis for how, you know, the bourgeoisie is able to galvanize support for interventionist strategies, interventionist policies. We talked about Brazil. Well, you know, there was a point that we were saying to people in this country, in the U.S., we've got to protect the project in Latin America, the progressive project in Latin America. We've got to protect Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and Nicaragua and Brazil. But we couldn't get traction because we were confused by the politics of Obama that was pushing the pro-imperialist agenda. And we could not understand that what was developing in Latin America, as in other parts of the world, was a real fundamental challenge to global white supremacy, to global imperialism. And we couldn't get ourselves to that point of understanding because of the confusion around things like humanitarian intervention, the responsibility to protect, this ability of the rulers to confuse people into supporting imperialism because it was suggesting that it was on the side of humanity, and large sections of the left fell for it. So, you know, we talked about the old days. In the old days, the left, despite what we may believe or think about what may be happening in particular countries, particular nations, we didn't get confused too often around what our responsibility was. Our responsibility then as today is to put a brake on U.S. imperialism. The most effective way of splitting and fragmenting this movement is when we begin to talk about what may be happening within the confines of these various nation states. The very fact that the U.S. is attempting to undermine a state, is providing support for so-called internal revolutionaries or whatever you want to call them, should be enough to cause some suspicion. Unless you believe that there's some kind of benevolent hegemon, that the U.S. actually stands on the side of humanity. If you have purged yourself of that kind of sentimentality, those kinds of distortions, then you would then maybe question, why is it that I'm on the same side as the U.S. state in support of some kind of intervention in name the country? Okay? So these are complex questions that we've got to really begin to tackle, because if we don't tackle them and confront them and overcome them, we're never going to be able to build the kind of movement we have to build and to live up to our responsibility here in North America.
This whole question of NGOs is something that, you know, in the past we didn't really have to deal with that much. But I believe it's a real strategy that they're using right now, and it really divides the left. It gets us on the wrong side of things. It takes money away from us. It takes cadre away that people need to be together and organizing. But it's not just in the United States. This is their strategy all over the world. Do you know in Ukraine, where the United States supported the coup that took place in Maidan. And this is something that some people are confused about, even on the left. You know, you could remember, what's her name, that woman who brought the cupcakes or whatever it was to the people in Maidan. Yeah, talking on the phone of who's going to be the next leader in Ukraine, and that's who became the next leader. Do you know there were 40,000 U.S. registered NGOs in Ukraine at that time? It's happened all over. Do you remember what happened in Cuba when USAID went in there and developed a kind of Twitter account that was there? Hundreds of thousands joined this Twitter thing, which was USAID, and when they had a certain mass of people on it, they got on and said, everybody out in the streets to oppose the government. Of course, nobody did in Cuba because it's a different kind of government than we have. So this is a very big thing. And the point that Phil made, it's not that the Democrats have ceded the working class to the Republicans. First of all, they never supported the working class. But the Democrats here and groups sometimes that call themselves socialists or left parties or workers' parties all over the world have come into power in the past, and they became the administrators of the austerity programs. And people who said, okay, well, if this is what's going to happen, remember what happened with Syriza in Greece? Everybody wanted them to break from the European Union so they wouldn't have to pay back this debt, which was going to cause people terrible hardships. And they said, they figured out the way to get around it. They said, let's have a vote. They had a vote. And people voted, break from the European Union, break from our debt. And the next day, they went against the people. And they settled for the debt and imposed austerity. It's still going on. That happens everywhere, and it happened with the Democratic Party in this country. They administered the policies that people are cringing from and dying from in this country. And racism is the basis of all of this. You know, in this country, we never dealt with slavery. We never dealt with white supremacy. We never dealt with racism. Not other countries haven't either in some ways. But if you go to Germany, you know, in their schools, it's mandatory that you take a course on Nazism and anti-Semitism so you could start to understand perhaps what that was about. They don't allow statues of Nazi leaders on their streets or roads named after Nazi leaders. If you want to say that's part of history, put it in a museum. But in this country, except for a very brief period called Radical Reconstruction, when blacks took over the legislators in the South, and the best legislation that ever came out of any legislatures in this country came out of those legislators, public education, public transportation, graduated tax systems, anti-discrimination laws. And then they pushed back with the Klan and got rid of the rights for blacks to even vote in the South and Jim Crow. And now there's statues all over. When a black goes to a courthouse to get justice, he has to pass a statue of a Confederate leader and drive on a road of a Confederate leader. And we have a president who gets up in a right-wing gathering, which he calls his rallies, and says, I'm a nationalist. He is white. And in that gathering, it's very clear. He means white nationalism. And that's what we have in this country. And until we deal with that, until we fight against it, until we end it, we're not going to get peace. We're not going to get the kind of society that we're all been talking about here today.
The reason I'm standing is to honor the women who in my community have been suffering one of the most... horrifying tactics of war, and that is rape and murder. And the long history of missing and murdered indigenous women on this continent is an issue that we struggle for with visibility. Just to be seen, just to be counted. One of my sisters, Anita Lucchesi, who is a doctoral student, who is an indigenous cartographer, and somebody who has created a database of indigenous missing and murdered women, who has been courted by the FBI to share her knowledge and expertise, for which she has politely declined and said, do your own job. I just want to honor her work. I want to honor all of the families who are suffering this ongoing act of war and genocide against our women and our children who go missing and nobody cares. That's the bottom line. And it's not just in this North America, but also South America. Women who stand up in protection of our homelands often go missing or murdered. And I just want to take a moment and honor those fallen sisters and remind everybody to remember that our struggle is not just for our sovereignty, but it is just a struggle to be seen.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the panel. A lot of great comments.